We were somewhere around Barstow, on the edge of the desert, when the drugs began to take hold.
Over the years, we've had no shortage of guests representing the counterculture or outsider art, whatever those terms may actually mean. From Pink Flamingos director John Waters to NFT megastar Beeple, we're always looking for those former or current, forgive the term, disruptors. But perhaps no guest has been more associated with the aesthetic of the counterculture than the artist on today's episode. Enter Ralph Steadman. Steadman is an English artist and illustrator best known for his long collaboration with the iconoclastic Hunter S. Thompson, notably illustrating Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Their partnership helped define gonzo journalism, a style of reporting that blends personal experience with political commentary. We recently caught up with Ralph, who turns 89 next month, and his daughter Sadie to discuss a career-spanning exhibition now on view at Oklahoma State University. It's up through May 10th, before continuing on to Maine, Virginia, and parts unknown. From Philbrick Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential.
Thank you for joining us today on the show. We're very honored to have you on to talk about this exhibition, talk about lots of different things. I'm curious to know, when I see you and your work described often, it describes you as an artist and illustrator, and I've always wondered why they don't just use the word artist. You know, do you view those two things very differently?
Yeah, I think they actually get used differently. An illustration is one sort of thing, has a kind of an attachment to it, I suppose. A drawing sometimes can be a technical drawing. And I think that's what I used to be, a draftsman, working with ruler and compass and a lot, you know, doing. And I was at de Havilland Aircraft Company. And with them, that was what I was going to do. I didn't like factory life, so I got a bit bored with the whole thing in the end. But I didn't really like factories. And I didn't particularly want to work in a factory for the rest of my life. So that was one other thing. Then I started going to a technical college, which became art college as well. And I kind of met the two together, and that's how I am drawing-wise.
I think you've always used technical drawing skills that you picked up. That's been a feature of his work since he started.
Horizons and things like that, you know.
Yeah.
Usually put compass for it.
Yeah, it seems like illustrator has a commercial. Sometimes when people use the word illustrator, it's almost tied to a commercial pursuit. You know, an artist is obviously its own thing, but it does seem like you've blended those things in a way that most people at least aspire to. With this show, it's looking at, you know, I think there's close to 140 or more than that works in the show. Do you think you're a good critic of your work in the sense of, you know, do you have any sense when you finish something, whether it's
good
or bad?
I don't swank about it. I don't see there's any point in that.
Of course, your work is so tied in with like the gonzo movement and Hunter Thompson, but that's a smidgen of the work, you know, really in the show. I particularly love the work that you've done for books, you know, Alice in Wonderland, Animal Farm, all those types of things. Yeah. When you're working on a project like that, does it matter to you whether you particularly love that book or not? You know, would you be willing?
I do, actually. I think it's a particularly wonderful book. Yeah. And also Through the Looking Glass, the two of them. Again, I realized reflection was important. Yeah. And seeing two sides of something always became very important. And reflection became important. And I like it a lot when reflection is a warped reflection, you know, reflects somehow in another way, in another surface. And all surfaces can be different too, which is interesting. And you just forever, well, I hope that would always be the case. I could be forever enjoying an effect, particularly an accidental one. When something accidental happens, I love it, you know. in some ways, you can't take praise for what you've done because there's so many other people that have helped me on my way, you know. And I think that I tried to, well, I certainly try to be modest about things and don't show off about it.
Yeah.
So in a way, I'm becoming quite boring, you know.
You know, your work in some ways is very American, right? Especially your work for Rolling Stone, all the pieces.
Well, because I worked for Americans all the time, you know. That's what's happening.
But the book work you've done is particularly English. You know, I love, like I said, we were talking about Orwell and we talked about Lewis Carroll. What do you think, coming from where you come from, do you have an understanding of America that came from doing the work, you know, going on those trips, doing those things?
So, yeah, meeting Hunter Thompson, a particularly American person, you know. Interesting too about Hunter is he was in the Air Force and I was in the Air Force and I didn't make that up, you know. It was just
happened. You did the national service about the same time.
Yeah, we did our same national service, yeah, 18 years of age. And there's a lot of reflective similarities about us, even though he's quite a different person. There's Rolf. And he always used my name. It would never, you know, no good if my name was Matthew. It wouldn't work the same. But Rolf was like a bark, you know.
Yeah.
Rolf. So I like to think maybe we were meant to meet, I don't know, you know, sometime.
Yeah.
And I like his son, Juan, and Sandy, his first wife.
Yeah, I've met Juan before. He's a really interesting guy, yeah.
Nice guy, yeah, lovely.
Yeah, he wrote a great book about growing up in that family.
Oh, he's done a book about growing up with Hunter.
Yeah, quite a memoir.
It's quite having a father like that's quite something, isn't it?
It's definitely worth writing a memoir about. So I love the kind of political stylings that you do because I love the idea of putting someone's personality into their character and how you can emphasize things or bring things out. We at the museum I work at here have a huge collection of Thomas Nast drawings and early political cartoons. Yeah. You know, what do you love and what have you loved about the task of trying to define a political persona or a person through drawing?
Well, I think it was the idea that I was on a journey and that I was therefore there to learn. And in both went to the Wrexham College of Art. I can't even remember that. That's the problem.
It was Wrexham Technical College.
Wrexham Technical College, which is where I started using a compass and a ruler.
When you did your apprenticeship.
I was doing geometric drawings, very geometric.
I think the political stuff, because you had to react quite quickly to things that were happening.
Yes.
So it's very kind of spontaneous. There's a real spontaneity to a lot of it. Do you know what I mean? Because you had to meet the deadline to get to the paper, to get it in print. Do you know what I mean? Very fast.
Yeah. And then I came up with an idea for a character called Teenie. And it was a teenage girl. And that became a daily, I had to do 6 a week. And there has to be one-off, you know, gags about Teeny.
That was in the 1960s, was it?
Yes, the 60s. Mm. So.
Different times.
Yeah.
Do you feel the same impulse? Meaning, does the idea machine ever stop? Or do you still see things?
I'm not doing it so much now. But you
did write this on the board. Like, we've got a board in the front row here.
What?
You suddenly wrote, Weasel on the Easel.
Oh, so yeah.
Class block jam.
Weasel on the Easel. There's a weasel on the easel.
So you're still writing down ideas and funny moments.
Yeah, so that thing, that's still smart. You know, I love what you've done with pigs in your work, for example. Pigs show up all the time.
Oh, yeah. Animal Farm, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, the weasel on the easel. So yeah, that's interesting. It's almost this. It's a.
And I have no idea what that's about. don't know what it's going to, you know.
Well, then that's okay.
I might get a pet weasel. Who knows?
I think you're always noting down ideas, and you've normally got a little.
I usually do if it makes sense as a little, you know. I wanted to sing as I tackled the thing that couldn't be done, and I did it.
Yeah.
1, 2.
What would you say people misunderstand about your work the most? You know, I think a lot of people think it's all done because of the frenetic nature of much of it. People think of it as like you must have just done it in the moment, or there wasn't thought behind it, or that it was just, it burst out of your mind or from your hand. But, you know, what do people get wrong? Really?
It would have come like that, really. Yeah.
But I think some of your books, like I, Leonardo, you would do a preliminary little idea. If you had an idea, there's a sketch for it, and then you can see how that becomes the main artwork. So I think there is sometimes, like when a book like that's yours, but I said, the political stuff, news stuff, you did have to react quite quickly. Yes. So there is kind of that energy and that spontaneity to it.
And the fact that I don't know why I thought of the way of saying, you know, that I was being a bit highfalutin when I thought I, Leonardo, was a bit presumptuous. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a bit, but it was a good name for the title, you know.
No, no one else thought to be Leonardo, did they? No one else thought, no. I shall try and be Leonardo. You decided to write.
I tried to be that way, yeah. So it's.
Was the only way you could get into the book, I think.
It was, and in the way I did get into it, you know.
I came home one day, he was throwing a flying machine off the roof.
Well, that was just,
yeah, I was about 11, 10 or 11. He was throwing a flying machine off the roof.
I did fly with it, you know.
He didn't jump off the roof.
No, I did. Luckily, I didn't go, no.
It didn't fly.
That's good. We might not be having this conversation if you had.
No. The thing went down like that, didn't it?
Yeah. And you sort of, yeah, there was a camera crew there as well. I was like, oh,
did they get any shots of that?
I think it's in that film. Was it, who did the film? Laurie Taylor or Mike?
Oh, Laurie Taylor, did he?
Was it Don't Tell Leonardo?
Don't Tell Leonardo, yeah.
I think it was the BBC.
Something like that. You see, there's a lot of things now that I've forgotten.
Well, there's a lot of things I'm just finding out. There's a lot of things I'm just finding out.
Really?
Yeah.
Blimey.
So scratch my name on your arm with a fountain pen. This means
this episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by fountain pens. Yeah, we know it's easier to get a ballpoint or a gel or a felt tip or a rollerball or whatever. They're cleaner, sure. Less time consuming, of course, and, you know, maybe less high maintenance, no argument here, but did you know that fountain pens were available in Europe as early as the 17th century? Pick up a fountain pen and you've got history on your side. And you think that Bic is going to age well? In 2010, a fountain pen sold for a staggering $8 million at an auction in Shanghai, smashing records for the most expensive pen ever sold. So, sure, if you want to, keep that fine point Sharpie. But you know it's true. Fountain pens are just a superior product. And if that wasn't enough, think how cool you're going to look holding that thing.
One of the things I enjoyed most about the exhibition was, we've touched on this a little bit, but was the variety of work, you know. And that's always interesting to me for, you know, and artists, so many artists get known for a certain period of their work or a certain work of their work. But even like bronze sculpture and things like that, is there an area besides drawing that you've loved to do that you maybe found later in life or are a medium that you just kind of loved?
Bits of something about objects and bits of things that I put together and make up.
Kind of like a found object piece?
Yeah, found objects. Oh, here we are, look.
That's heavy.
This is heavy, but it's solid. Look.
Okay, so describe what we're looking at, Sadie, if you can.
An owl.
It's an old bit of sort of architrave, really hefty bit of wood that probably be on the corner of a building or something.
Okay.
And on top of it, a piece of, I suppose, scrap or driftwood that has been carved into the sort of vaguely carved and painted to be an owl. It's very simple. But obviously the shape suggested that to Dad, so that's what he has created.
He did, yeah.
It's kind of this triangular carving with a little bit of cutout for two legs.
It's a bit simple, really.
I love it. I love it. What is it about animals specifically? You seem to love to depict animals.
Well, I think, first of all, the idea that I like the idea of the preservation. It is something that is important that I grew up always having a care for little creatures, you know, that I didn't want to. Although I had a catapult, I really didn't use it much, you know. I wasn't meant to be cruel, I don't think. I didn't like it. The whole idea of human beings being rather thoughtless and unpleasant doesn't appeal to me much, you know.
Yeah.
No, I mean, how do you feel about Trump?
It's an interesting question, though. Has the discord in America over these last years caused you to be more engaged with the work? Are you doing work? Or, we talked about your idea about the weasel and the easel, but are there things when you read the newspaper that...
I tried the Statue of Liberty. Did I consider, what did I say about that?
You said it was the Statue of Liberty Takers.
The Statue of Liberty Takers.
Yeah.
Trump.
And I brought him into it.
Before we run out of time, I do want to touch on one thing, which is, you know, this exhibition is traveling around, and we're very lucky to have it here in Oklahoma at the University, Oklahoma State University. But when a curator is putting a show together of your work, do you like to be involved in it? Do you view it as, hey, you do what you want to do, that's your project? How hands-on do you like?
There's a bit of both, actually.
I think you got it when Andrea, who's our exhibition coordinator and co-curator, you kind of got kind of interested in what was being included, and then you went and you pulled something out of a drawer and you were like, I want this in it, though. And it's one of some dogs, it's collage, and I think it was put it with the children's works, but it's kind of almost a random, it doesn't, you know, it's almost like one day you want to do something, you just took a line for a walk, and it's like a collage of lots of different dogs. And so you got kind of interested in...
I think I was trying to contribute something.
Yeah. I think if you hadn't liked anything, you would have said. You would have
said, I think so, yeah.
For God's sake, don't put that in there.
Well, I didn't say that.
No, because you were quite happy with it. I think you went through it with Andrea, and she said that you really enjoyed looking through it all.
Yes.
Even for you, it was a bit of a journey going from the early days all the way through to quite late stuff. So
yeah.
I think what we want to do, we want to show as much variety as possible, and we wanted to give a few for surprises. So people who thought, well, I'm such a Stedman fan, even they should come in and be, I've never seen them. My God, I've never seen that one before. Do you know what I mean?
My fans would probably remember more about what I've done than I do.
Fans serve as a collective memory, you know, for all of us. Yeah, exactly.
Do that.
Well, my last question for you is this. You know, we are a podcast that's all about museums, so I would be remiss not to ask you this. Did museums play a role in your life as a child? Did your
Well, I don't know about as a child, but certainly when I become a teenager, I really wanted to.
Not many museums in Abergele, are there?
Not really, no.
Yeah.
Because I was brought up in Wales.
Yeah.
Not the animal, you know.
You're not Jonah.
Jonah. Is it Jonah and the whale? All right.
No, okay. But maybe there's a drawing there.
Leave your kids behind. Come with us and find the pleasures of the journey to the center of the mind. Come along if you can.
There's a somewhat secret LSD museum inside a Victorian mansion in San Francisco. It's a time capsule of the late 60s heyday and displays approximately 30,000 hits of acid. There's no sign outside, no posted hours. But if you find it, and the timing is just right, you might even be lucky enough to get a guided docent-style tour from the collector, homeowner, and brains behind the operation, Mark McLeod. Now remember, dear listeners, you didn't hear this from us. And if you're feeling a little uneasy about knowing this information, remember one thing. Nobody likes a narc. Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about the station or the museum, visit publicradiotulsa.org or philbrook.org or both. As always, we suggest both. Until next time, look closer.